And welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm Carol Van Dam in Washington, and here are some of the stories making news across South Sudan and the rest of the region this Friday, November 3rd, 2023. A South Sudanese official says parents whose children were abducted need psychological support.
It's basic water supply at 41% and basic sanitation at 11%. The most alarming trend is that 63% of the population still practice over identification.
That was a UNICEF official saying many South Sudanese risk contracting diseases because of improper sanitation. We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. Authorities in South Sudan's Ruing administrative area say there is renewed fighting between the Sudan Armed Forces and the paramilitary Rapid Support Forces in neighboring West Kordofan State. VOA's Charlton Doki wrote this report, which is narrated by John Tanza.
The Sudan Armed Forces and the paramilitary group Rapid Support Forces fought in Karsila, a place near oil-producing area of Heglige, on Wednesday. Santo Yuol Mayuen, the acting information minister in Ruing administrative area, tells VOA sources close to the border informed him that today's fighting took place in two areas, one in Mujlid and the other one in Babanusa in the neighboring West Kordofan state. There are no details of casualties from the fighting or information on who controls the two places at the moment. Mayuen says aid workers stationed in Panakwach, Bayam of Ruing administrative area along the Sudan-South Sudan border, are on the lookout for any civilians fleeing the fighting who might cross into South Sudan so as to provide humanitarian assistance. The United Nations Refugee Agency, or UNHCR, said earlier this week that it has seen an increase in the number of Sudanese refugees arriving in South Sudan over the past 3 weeks. Marie Helen Vanney, the UNHCR representative for South Sudan, told VOA the increase is due to the spread of fighting in the southern part of Sudan, including White Nile, West, North, and Southern Kordofan states. The United Nations says at least 9,000 people have been killed since the outbreak of conflict, while 5.6 million others have been displaced from their homes since the conflict broke out in Sudan in mid-April. Charlton Doki prepared this report. I'm John Tanza, reporting from Juba.
The head of the Liria Payam in Juba County of Central Equatoria State says cases of alcohol abuse among parents are on the rise after their children were abducted by men suspected of having crossed into the area from Jungale State and the Greater Pibor Administrative Area. Christopher Sebet Arcangelo, executive director of the Liria Payam, says international and local organizations handling cases of traumatized South Sudanese should dispatch a team to the Payam to offer services to parents, saying they need counseling or psychosocial support. John Tanza has more for VOA from Juba.
One of my actual recommendations is that let the central government organize a meeting of these three states to address this issue, and then each state to take drastic measures to put an end to this child abduction. I think it will work well. I
mean, if this has been happening from 1989 to date, it appears like very little is done to arrest the situation. What kind of drastic measures are you proposing?
Yeah, I'm saying even it has to be made a law, you know, to punish the perpetrators of abduction. And that law is to be implemented. And if that one can be done, I think it will deter perpetrators. And that's one. And then the other thing is each state is to put down some regulatory measures and even to check the movement of, I said, particularly in Jungle where the abductors, come from. The government there must be serious. should not allow anybody to move away out from there. They have to be, the movement of the people in and out has to be regulated.
So you are talking about it should be made into a law. It involves lawmakers.
Exactly.
And have you been in touch with lawmakers from your area?
Yeah, I'm in touch with lawmakers in my area. We have one minister. I was in touch with him. I also share with him the finding of the research, and that there is a need really for the government to work hard to stop this child abduction. And currently also have one minister from my area. That's the Minister of Peace Building in Central Equatoria. I also is working hard, and I'm working hand in hand with him to address this issue.
Mr. Christopher, from my discussion with you, it appears like you're overwhelmed with this child abduction in Liria Payam. You have made your findings available to people in power who are supposed to make decisions to put an end to this child abduction. And it appears no action has taken place. How do you feel?
I'm actually happy about what I was told 2 days ago here in Juba when I came from Liria. I was told our government of Central Equatoria is planning to send a team to Jongole. To Jongole and Bibora Greater Administrative Area, you know, to dialogue with those authorities and find ways of addressing this issue of child abduction. I think that is a positive step, and that is what I proposed along in 2013. And to make it more clear, you know, the Lokoya area is divided into two. There is part of it is in eastern Equatoria and the other part in central Equatoria. So the other part in eastern Equatoria is also experiencing child abduction too. That is why I said it is the concern of this three states to come together with the help of the national government to address the issue.
What is so particular about the children in areas where the Lokoya are, whether in central or eastern Equatoria? Why is it that people who are involved in this child abduction only go to those areas?
It's actually a difficult question to talk about. Maybe they have seen that the local authorities there are weak.
If the local authority is weak, that means your administration is weak too.
That's correct. That's what I'm saying. When you talk of local defense, you mean the police who are there, the national security or other security organs. If there are only 7 police in the area and they are only stationed at the headquarters of the Payam, so how about the other Payam which are far away from the headquarters like Langabu? It is being targeted most of the time.
It's very painful to see your child disappearing or being taken by somebody whom you don't know. And I know that you are in touch with parents whose children have been abducted. What do they tell you? How do they feel?
I encountered a family that lost almost all the children. And the mother is now went crazy. And the father also is crazy.
You mean they developed mental problems?
Yeah, mental problem. Yeah, the both of them. The mother went to the extent of saying it is better to die. She is now drinking beer, you know, taking alcohol excessively. This is one experience I encounter in one of the bombers there. Some of the families that lost children to the abductors, they don't feel like having a stable mind. Some do not go to church. They say it is better, to die.
You're telling me there is a feeling of hopelessness, frustration, and this is leading to depression, and some people are finding refuge in alcohol, and others are developing mental problems. What is the Payam doing to address this issue?
At the moment, I'm engaged with the UN, mostly. The UNMIS are also with me, and I talked to them about it. I said there is a need to, you know, to do a lot of peace building in the area to, you know, as a way of reducing the trauma, because many people are traumatized by losing their children. As you said, it is true. Losing a child like that, for example, you have 4 children and you lose them all. And you are at the age of which I don't think whether you will really reproduce again or not. So I think it is painful. That's why I'm working, I'm lobbying to see to it that together with the development partners if they can do something, at least to build, if we do some peace building workshops in the area, at least that aim at healing trauma of the people.
That is Christopher Sebit Arcangelo, Executive Director of the Liria Payam, speaking with my colleague John Tanza in Juba. UN human rights officials on Friday reported that an increasing number of women and girls have been abducted and sexually violated by men affiliated with the paramilitary rapid support forces in Sudan's volatile Darfur region. Lisa Schlein has this report for VOA from Geneva.
The UN Human Rights Office says it has been receiving deeply alarming reports of the abduction and rape of Sudanese women and girls in areas controlled by the rapid support forces in Darfur. Human rights spokesperson Liz Throssell says the women and girls reportedly are being held in inhumane, degrading, slave-like conditions where they allegedly are forcibly married and held for ransom.
Credible information from survivors, witnesses, and other sources suggests more than 20 women and girls have been taken, but the numbers could be higher. Some sources have reported seeing women and girls in chains on pickup trucks and in cars.
Throssell says this shocking situation is most likely much worse than the numbers indicate. She notes the cases of conflict-related sexual violence are never fully reported because of the shame attached to these violations. She says reports of gender-based violence began surfacing soon after fighting erupted between the Sudanese armed forces and the paramilitary RSF on April 15th. She says initial allegations arose in the Khartoum area, which has been largely under RSF control.
One of the reports indicated that women and girls had been abducted and detained at a location in the city's Al-Riyad district from as early as the 24th of April. Since then, we have continued to receive reports of abductions, with an increasing number of cases being reported in the Darfur region, particularly north, central and south Darfur and in the Kordofan region.
Since the start of the conflict, the Joint Human Rights Office in Sudan has documented at least 105 people who have been subjected to sexual violence, including 23 rapes, 26 gang rapes, and 3 attempted rapes. UN rights officials are calling for the prompt release of the abducted women and girls, for all alleged cases of sexual violence to be investigated, and for perpetrators of these crimes to be brought to justice. The RSF and the Sudanese army have both denied allegations of human rights abuses against civilians while accusing each other of committing rights violations. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus on The Voice of America. Coming up on South Sudan in Focus, was King Charles's visit to Kenya a success? Stay tuned. You're listening to South Sudan in Focus on The Voice of America. The United Nations Children's Agency, or UNICEF, is expressing concern about open defecation in some parts of South Sudan, saying the practice increased the spread of waterborne diseases in the country. UNICEF says most of the rural population still practices open defecation. He adds that only 11% of the population has practiced basic hygiene. The newly established South Sudan Paramilitary Caucus on Water, Sanitation, and Hygiene, or called WASH, says it is formulating laws and policies to discourage people from practicing open defecation across the country. Munyang David Mayar reports for VOA from Juba.
The newly established South Sudan Parliamentary Caucus on Water, Sanitation and Hygiene, or WASH, says it is formulating laws and policies to discourage people from the practice of open defecation. Speaking at the launch of WASH in Juba today, Ismail Kamil, UNICEF representative in South Sudan, says a lack of hygiene is especially a problem in rural areas.
Indeed, WASH coverage continues to be very low, with basic water supply at 41% and basic sanitation at 11%. The most alarming trend is that 63% of the population still practice open defecation.
According to a survey conducted by the National Ministry of Health in 2020, open defecation is most common in the Upper Nile region. It says up to 97% of the population practice open defecation, and it is also common in Jonglei and Unity State. The survey found that open defecation is least practiced in Western Equatoria State, where a little less than a third of the population relieve themselves in public. Camille says widespread displacement due to armed conflict prevents many people from accessing water, sanitation and hygiene services such as pit latrines.
We all know that South Sudan continues to be affected by conflict in some areas and threat of conflict in others. This situation, coupled with the impact of climate change, a long-standing environment of poverty, lack of infrastructure, and food insecurity, has caused mass displacement. This protracted conflict has continued to affect the already poor rate of access to basic facilities, including safe water.
In August, the Minister of Water Resources and Irrigation announced a presidential compact on water and sanitation to achieve universal access to clean drinking water and sanitation in the country, including a country-free open defecation by 2026. Bangwad Amom is chairperson of the Parliamentary Specialized Committee for Water Resources and Irrigation.
As lawmakers, we have a crucial role in facilitating and supporting this agenda. Through the South Sudan Parliamentary Caucus on Water, Sanitation and Hygiene, we have an opportunity to drive political will and legislative action toward the realization of this vision. We will work with other key stakeholders, including the government institution, civil society organizations, development partners, and to mobilize resources and to develop policies, legislation, and oversee their implementation.
National MPs say they believe a lack of laws and policies to enforce water, sanitation and hygiene practices is the reason most South Sudanese in the countryside defecate in public. Amom says the government must provide adequate funding so government agencies can implement the campaign.
To enable us to do this awareness and campaign, toilet has to be our slogan and has to be our action.
For VOA News, I'm Anyang David Mayor in Juba.
Britain's King Charles and Queen Camilla wrapped up a four-day visit to Kenya today. During his visit, King Charles addressed what's been called the wrongdoings of Britain's colonial era. He told a state banquet in Nairobi of his greatest sorrow and regret, but the king did not deliver a formal apology for abuses during colonial times. Macharia Munene, professor of history and international relations at the United States International University in Nairobi, tells me that the royal couple were received as visitors, and Kenyans follow a tradition of treating their visitors well until they misbehave.
Since invited by the president, there are visitors of the state, but not much was expected from them because they're just visitors. There were, of course, assumptions by some people that their visit is a good opportunity to make demands of some sort and hope that they may be able to address some concerns. Those expectations were misplaced, as far as I'm concerned, were. But there was nothing wrong with people taking advantage of an opportunity to make some claims. So they came in as first as visitors, but mostly it was a sentimental trip. Given that Charles, his mother became queen when she was watching animals in Kenya. And so there was a sentimental part of it, emotional connection. The fact that they also, the royal family also owns property in Kenya, enabled him to say that he has come home. And it was, may have been speaking very figuratively, but it is also very literally true. Because if you have some property in a place, then that's also your home, one of your homes. So you had to come for that.
Older people, I've seen older people interviewed, older Kenyans, and they remember those days. And they, some of them were even abused and tortured. And, you know, they don't forget.
they don't forget that, and they want more than just deep regret, right?
No, there are some people who want apologies. That is true. They would like to see some reparations of some kind. It becomes difficult, if one is realistic, to expect that Charles, who has no power in England, other than symbolic power and influence, because it's a government thing, and the government, the way that I understand it, is run in England. Those Rishi Sunak and the people in parliament and all those kind of things.
Do you think that people in Kenya still are holding out hope that the government of the UK will do something more official?
I don't think so. Well, you have a few people still making demands for symbolic purposes, but the reality on the ground is that it may not. Those who know that it may not happen. But that does not stop political demonstrations, because even the demonstrations is good business for some people, political games. And so the visit itself is sentimental as far as I'm concerned. It also serves two people, the interest of two people. That's the interest of Charles himself and the president who invited him. One of the things they have in common is a desire to be liked and to at least promote the acceptability beyond some place. For Charles, he's busy trying to build a name for himself as the leader of the Commonwealth. His mother was fairly accepted in the Commonwealth. He himself has to establish his own credentials. And he is now on a mission to try and establish that acceptability across the Commonwealth. And if he's acceptable across the Commonwealth, then it's possible that in other places he also be seen as a good man, accepted. The issue of reparations is a sensitive one, and because it requires that Charles admit liability. I don't think that to say that colonialism was evil, and it was evil, but for him and others to admit that becomes a little difficult. And if they were to admit that colonialism was evil, therefore apologize for it, then they will be duty-bound to pay reparations and some compensations which they are not interested in doing.
That's Muchara Munene, professor of history and international relations at the U.S. International University in Nairobi. He was speaking to me today from the Kenyan capital. American Muslim groups say the Biden administration's efforts to combat rising Islamophobia in the U.S. must go hand in hand with the protection of civilians in Gaza from Israel's retaliatory strikes against Hamas that have killed thousands of Palestinians. White House Bureau Chief Patsy Whitaker-Squara reports.
Incidents of Islamophobia are on the rise following Hamas' October 7 attack on Israel, including the killing of a Palestinian-American boy last month, allegedly in a hate crime. Mahmoud Yusuf, the boy's great uncle.
A 71-year-old man sitting on top of a 6-year-old kid, stabbing her more than 26 times.
As the war in Gaza intensifies, Islamophobia and anti-Semitism in the U.S. have increased. The administration released its national strategy to counter anti-Semitism in May. It said it has long worked on a strategy to counter Islamophobia. White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre.
This is an administration that's taken action, not just the last couple of weeks or the last couple of months, but started this process back in December of last year.
Deputy Executive Director of the Council on American Islamic Relations, Edward Ahmed Mitchell, via Zoom.
It is important for the White House to develop a plan to combat Islamophobia, but that plan must begin first and foremost with calling for an end to the Israeli government's bombardment of the Gaza Strip. That violence in Gaza is what is fueling unrest and bigotry around the world, including the targeting of Muslim Palestinian Americans.
That was White House Bureau Chief Patsy Whitaker-Squara reporting. Well, it's that time of the week when we hear what you have to say about news developments with our listener comment segment by Charlton Doki. Take it away, Charlton.
Thanks, Carol Van Damme. We begin with condolence messages from our listeners. Ayen Yakdao in Uganda's Arua City writes, "My condolences to the family and people of South Sudan on the untimely death of Bishop Emeritus Paride Taban. His struggle during the War of Liberation is something to be remembered. As Bishop of Torit Diocese, he contributed massively to make sure that South Sudan gained independence. May his soul rest in eternal peace." Antonio Maguek Machar in Maria Low Payam writes, "Hello VOA. I am in grief due to the death of our Bishop Paride Taban. He did a lot for the needy. It's a great loss to the whole of South Sudan and the rest of Africa. May the Almighty God rest his soul in peace." Peter Ajak Ayom writes, "Hello John Tanza and Nabil Biajo. Let me have this opportunity to register my heartfelt condolences to the Diocese of Torit, the Catholic Church at large, the communities in Eastern Equatoria and the people of South Sudan for the passing of Bishop Emeritus Paride Taban. Bishop Paride Taban was not merely a religious leader, he was a torchbearer of hope and a peacemaker and a father to South Sudan. Today, as we come to know that you are gone, your departure, Bishop, has left a remarkable footprint that will inspire us forever, and your legacy will remain in our hearts. Rest in eternity until we meet again." Sabir Isaac Kamis in Yambio, Western Equatoria State writes, "Allow me to extend my heartfelt condolences to the entire Catholic believers worldwide, and in particular South Sudan, for the untimely death of Bishop Paride Taban. He was a dedicated church leader who really served his God and community diligently. May his precious soul rest in eternal peace. Our solidarity is with his immediate family and those mourning him. God gives and takes. May his name be glorified." Samuel Remo in Yei writes, "Hi John Tanza and Nabil Biajo. The 400% increment in salaries of civil servants and members of the organized forces is fine, but my worry is this money will move out of the country because we don't have factories, industries, and our local farmers are unable to produce food due to climate change and instability in the country. I ask the government to speed up the implementation of the peace agreement because we common citizens in the country and those who are in refugee camps are dying of hunger and diseases." Thok Chuni Yokwai from Juba writes, "Hello VOA. To me, what's going on between Israeli forces and Hamas forces in Gaza is not a good move. I am calling on the Israeli forces and the Hamas forces to stop fighting and to resolve their problem on the table, not by the guns." Mal Adau Mal in Seattle, USA writes, "Hello South Sudan in Focus editor Caro. There is flagrant violation of the so-called international law in Gaza, and the UN is conspicuously watching the annihilation of innocent civilians. To what benefit is it to the UN when such a significant number of people die on daily basis?" And finally, Mading Malwal Aluang in Juba writes, "It's a great concern that President Kiir dismissed the former rebel David Yau Yau from the SPLM and as well from the Transitional National Legislative Assembly. This move is creating panic among the public. Yau Yau was one of the brutal and decisive rebels after the independence of South Sudan who killed thousands of government forces in the time of rebellion. President Kiir should keep all power-hungry politicians until the end of this transitional period." These listener comments are neither views of VOA nor South Sudan in Focus.
And that wraps it up for us this Friday. We invite you to check out voaafrica.com for all your favorite programs and news updates. If you somehow missed this broadcast, just head on over to www.voaafrica.com/South Sudan. We now leave you with the song Break Your Back by Awilo. I'm your host, Carol Van Dam in Washington. On behalf of our engineer, Zaida Hamzoun, and producer, Kwame Afori, thanks for being here. Have a great weekend, everybody, and we'll see you back here on Monday for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.